Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter. A warm welcome to our listeners. Thank you for tuning in. In today's podcast, we're going to be discussing migration, youth, and gender in North Africa with Khaled Ben Mansour, an activist dedicated to advocating for women's and children's rights from Tunisia. She's currently an African Youth Ambassador for Peace with the African Union for North Africa, is a women peace builder, and works with several INGOs. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here with you.
Thanks so much for joining. Let's start with an overview of the region, including conflict history, livelihoods, and how climate change is impacting those two things in North Africa.
Very good question. I think in setting the stage of the conversation, we can go through an overview of the conflict history and the impacts of climate change in North Africa and how these two factors can actually interfere, especially in impacting the livelihoods. I think North Africa is a very special region in terms of climate change risks and the ongoing impacts of this phenomenon on the region. And mainly, we have seen that it's representing a particular challenge with regards to transboundary or cascading climate risks, particularly given its high levels of water stress and the importance of water in several key sectors and systems in the region. We know that right now there is a prediction that the region is bound to become hotter and drier in the future. And there are already other factors that are impacting the livelihoods in North Africa. I'll just narrow it down to maybe three factors, perhaps to keep it very brief. Mainly the rise in inequalities. We know that there is now a challenge on managing the natural resources, or let's say the allocation of the resources. There is a decrease in the management of these resources, especially for some sectors that are really dependent on the climate change scenario. So that can be exacerbating more conflict in the region whenever there is a fight over resources that can actually be already a heating position for the region to face more conflict over resources. And also the last one would be the policy incoherence. We know when the government or the institutions or the policymakers, they don't have incoherent measures to face the ongoing climate challenges, that can be actually another factor too. So basically, based on the existing research, we know that there are different ways through which climate-related security and development risks can lead to conflict. As I mentioned, there is the growing competitions over resources, the rise in inequalities, the undermining livelihoods, and also there are different mechanisms that interfere in this. Climate change is also expected to lead to rising sea levels and coastal degradation in North Africa, and expected to have a determinal effect on critical infrastructure, as well as housing and tourist infrastructure, and lead to unemployment and out-migration. I think the climate change effects have been a progressive and evolving phenomena in the region, leading to more alerting challenges and making the region already facing so many factors and impacts, which is in a way or another making it very fragile in the face of climate change and its underlying impacts.
I want to drive our conversation a little bit towards migration and displacement in the region. And I think a lot of times when people think of migration in North Africa, what comes to mind are headlines regarding these migration routes from Libya and Tunisia to the EU through Italy or Malta. And you hear a lot about human trafficking and coast guards regularly intercepting and returning migrant boats in the Mediterranean Sea. And oftentimes these are very tragic stories that are making headlines. What are these headlines missing? And to any extent, do they capture any of the realities that are occurring?
I think the migration context in the last few years in the Mediterranean especially the media's reporting on migration, focused almost exclusively on the numbers of people fleeing their home countries as a result of conflict or other contextual factors, and the effects of these flows of people on transit and destination countries. So as a result, the media also contributed to the perception that migration was a problem.
Media can be a really powerful tool, and it's really important that it presents not only the context and what it's happening, but provides the full picture, where migration can also be an opportunity and it can also be a positive thing. I also want to look a little bit at who is migrating and bring in your expertise on women's rights a little bit. So women comprise almost half of the international migrant population. What kind of gender-specific social and cultural norms influence both if women decide to migrate and what their experiences are in the process? And if you could expand a little on what kind of gender-based risks policymakers and decision makers need to be aware of when working on these kinds of topics like migration and mobility and creating policy around it.
I like the fact that we shifted to gender, and it's really important that we highlight women's rights and the integration of the gender aspect in this conversation. When it comes to migration, some women migrants face situations where they are more vulnerable to violence. Numerous factors influence a person's risks and vulnerabilities throughout their migration journey, and women are no exclusion to that. Alongside gender, a key factor is whether the migration route is safer and regular or not. I think when women are migrating, they are more tendent to face a lot of challenges than men, because they are more tendent to face gender-based violence, exploitation, harassment, human trafficking and smuggling, etc. Rape also. I think the routes are not as safe as they should be, and most of the cases, women lose their lives or they get a lot of psychological traumas when they are migrating. So today, in managing related policy challenges, I think the government must balance the need for rapid responses with the need to uphold the values of transparency, fairness, accountability, and inclusiveness. Whenever we are talking about migration, regulations, human rights, borders, control, human trafficking, and more, anything related to the migration phenomenon, I think we should really focus a lot on the gender aspect and mostly on women's rights and women who are migrating today, because we cannot speak about an inclusive world and healthy process for women to migrate without incorporating the legal aspect of it, the global frameworks that protect women's rights. And it's very important today that we know that women are migrating almost for the same purposes and the same reasons as men. And they are seeking the same decent working opportunities, the same decent lifestyle that men will look for whenever they are migrating to the other destinations. I think another point that we need to highlight is that countries must ensure that the human rights of women, men, and girls and boys are respected at all stages of the migration process, and that these rights should be specific and that should reflect the needs. And these needs should be properly understood and addressed, and that they are empowered as agents of change. I think whenever we speak about the global frameworks or the global policies, we need to know that we are addressing men and women both as equal contributors to society, both as members of the development process, both as agents of change and contributors to sustainable development. These policies or initiatives should be complemented by measures that support victims and that ensure them effective prosecutions for all crimes. And we need to treat women who are facing abuse, psychological traumas, harassment, or any sort of violence as real victims. We need to listen to them. We need to encourage them. We need to support them. For some women, migrating is a choice. For others, migration is an obligation. It's sometimes a difficult process that women, especially at a very young age, have to go through, and they have to face horrible consequences and horrible scenarios to go to the other side. So I think whenever we are talking about human rights, it's the basic norm that we provide gender-responsive measures and mechanisms to migration. And to have a gender-responsive governance, especially when it comes to reducing gender-based violence, ensuring also the lives of all migrants are protected and that they have access to justice, reduces their vulnerabilities and alters the culture of impunity in which perpetrators believe that they will not face punishment. We need to make everyone understand that regardless of the context in which migrants are, human rights would be respected, would be applied for equal process for men and women, and there will be punishment for all crimes, and that women will be respected wherever, whenever they are.
While we're discussing women's rights, I also want to talk about the fact that you're part of the Young Women Peace Builders Program by the UN Women Office of the Arab States. And to give a little background, the year 2000 was the first time the UNSC addressed the disproportionate and unique impact of armed conflict on women and recognized the undervalued and also underutilized contributions that women make to conflict prevention, peacekeeping, conflict resolution, and peace building. What kind of progress have you seen in moving beyond the rhetoric to ensure that women's equal and full participation as active agents in peace and security?
Very good question. I think I'll give you both examples from the UN perspective and from my experience within the African Union, as I currently serve as the Youth Ambassador for Peace to the AU. To be honest, what I really loved recently about the whole engagement of young people is that we are becoming more vocal and we are not just stopping at the advocacy level. We are not just the spaces that are presented to us. We are actually witnessing some change in the classic scenarios. I would say that we are trying to shift the narratives in a way that they become truly led by young people, for some spaces to be not only inclusive in the way that we are inviting people to just participate, but we are inviting them as key contributors to change the classic scenarios. And that's something I really admired and I have concretely witnessed, especially within the UN Women Gender Innovation Agora, as I take part of the network as an advisor to the UN Women Agora team. I think when we are trying to set some strategies, regional strategies, for example, we are not only participating in the regular meeting as young people who are just given their opinions, but we are invited as young experts, as young peace builders. We are using our creative thinking, our creative tools in a way that we are contributing to these strategies to be adapting to the current context in which we are living. For example, the Gender Innovation Agora includes different countries from the MENA region, Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, and more. And I think it was very important to gather this diverse perspective in the sense that each person that is participating, they are bringing their own perspective, they are bringing their own experiences and background in the field of peace building and taking part in the building and designing of that strategy. Also, there is an important element that we are using innovation. We are using technology for setting these strategies. We are trying to be as creative as possible. And that actually does help in building new approaches to change the social norms. We are actually using technology to build this new kind of mindset to change the classic scenarios that we see in our countries and to eliminate some of the issues that have been existing for so long. So that's something that I was really impressed with when I saw that we have so much potential, we have so much capacity that we can actually collectively work on in order to build strategies that can actually go far further than we expected. And to be able to contribute fully from the design to the implementation process in regional strategies within the UN is something really big. And if you asked me like 2 to 3 years ago, if I was able to see that, I would say it's really impossible and only few people would access that. And today we are able to see that, especially in the Arab world. It's a delicate context where young women are vocal about their rights and needs. And to see that we already starting to make some changes, it's really important. Now, for the African Union context, it's really special because we are seeing the existence of different programs and different initiatives for young people. It's actually a direct open call for all African youth to be involved in the decision-making processes and the policy-making processes. We are accessing today, as youth ambassadors for peace, rooms with member states, with officials from our countries and beyond. And that itself is huge. Not to mention that you are also contributing to the change of some of the most alerting conflicts in our regions. And we are actually addressing the member states as young diplomats, as young politicians, as young leaders. We are addressing them in some of the critical challenges that we are concerned with as young people before being youth ambassadors. So whenever I see that we are invited to the Peace and Security Council, for example, we are invited to a meeting within the presidency house, whenever we are invited to high-level decision-making rooms, it can only motivate me, to be honest, to know that today we have a seat at the table. And that's the kind of progressive route that young people have been taking. That's where we want to see. Of course, it's not enough. Of course, we are still making a call to be fully included in these rooms. We don't want to access to be limited. We don't want to see people still struggling with their visa problems to be invited to such rooms. We don't want to see the financial challenges or constraints that block young people from participating. We want to see more of that. And my colleague, the youth ambassador for Southern Africa, actually participated yesterday at the UN Security Council open debate with Switzerland as they take the presidency for the Security Council for the month of May. And she addressed the exact same issue and she delivered for the first time a brief on the YPS agenda at the UN. A huge milestone for us as the Youth Ambassadors for Peace and also a very important discussion. It's an open call for all member states to include young people today. I think this is one tiny example of how we should see young people today. We don't want to see a gap between the representation of young people and the policymakers. And also in terms of gender, we don't want to see only men at the table. We also want to see an equal representation in terms of gender. So I think beyond the rhetoric ways, I think we are seeing some of the participation being equally represented. And we are seeing young people being vocal as active agents in peace and security today.
That's really exciting. And you paint a really positive picture of youth being seen as experts, as peace builders, actually having a seat at the table and youth engagement within these really high level systems seems to be going in the right direction. I also want to talk a little bit about communities or the livelihoods of people at large and talking about youth in terms of what kind of socioeconomic factors drive migration and what kind of consequences this has for society to have young groups of people leaving. What can providing opportunities actually look like to encourage young people to build livelihoods and have the option to do this where they're from?
I think some of the socioeconomic factors that are impacting young people, and it's definitely a common one in all of the regions, I think that is unemployment. It's actually leading in a way or another to extreme poverty for some countries in Africa or beyond. And it's leading to a pressure that in a way or another creates frustration, because when you are not provided with an equal opportunity for employment or you are not able to contribute effectively to society, eventually there is a frustration that is created inside the young person's mindset. If they are not presented with decent work opportunities or with opportunities where they can contribute positively in society, they would take the route that is migration. And to some extent, they would actually follow extreme delicate scenarios or they would follow extreme routes of violent extremism, terrorism, human trafficking, and more. And that actually itself is threatening not only to their own peace and security, but also to the society in which they belong. So I think today there is a direct interest in finding suitable ways and measures to protect young people before providing them with the opportunity. I think these are one of the pillars also mentioned in the continental framework of youth peace and security for the African Union: prevention, protection, participation, partnerships and coordination, disengagement and rehabilitation. And in the prevention pillar, we actually highlight the need for member states to prevent the ongoing challenges from occurring or from getting close to young people. And as much as it sounds easy to say it, but we definitely need to look today on inclusive working opportunities for men and women so that they are really focusing on being active agents of economic development, economic growth, drivers of change, then shifting their mindsets to risking their lives and taking extreme difficult paths. So I think this is one of the most important factors that is impacting young people in the region and driving them to migrate elsewhere. Of course, there are other different challenges and other factors like the political situation that we are currently facing. When you are living in a context or an environment that is constantly pressuring, constantly affected by violence, by armed groups, by political instability and tensions, eventually that cannot be a safe environment where you can dream, have ambitions, build capacity, and more. So I think when some young people try to migrate, they are actually seeking safety. They are actually seeking peace and seeking an environment where they can actually be productive and feel like they belong to a society that is welcoming and accommodating. Some of the other factors we already highlighted at the beginning of the discussion, like climate change, the ongoing challenges that we are seeing in our countries, and they can be enough drivers for people to start thinking about migration, especially today that we are facing with an economic global crisis that is making a lot of inflation rates to impact young people's minds. And the lack of opportunities itself is a major constraint to our participation. So whenever we have this thought that we know there is a place or there is an environment where the opportunities are existing, they are empowering, they are involving enough and accommodating for young people, that can be considered as a paradise to a lot of people. So unless you have a sense of resilience and engagement and leadership to make the change, that would be very challenging for one person to stay in an environment that is impacted by so many factors.
I like your point of participation at every level being necessary. So I want to come back to this idea of a youth ambassador. And as mentioned, you're currently an African Youth Ambassador for Peace with the African Union. What does this mean to be a youth ambassador? And if you could shed some light on what your role looks like within the institution a little bit.
Absolutely. This is always my favorite question when I speak about the Youth for Peace Africa program and the African Youth Ambassadors for Peace. Of course, the Peace and Security Council requested the commission to appoint 5 regional Youth Ambassadors for Peace, or AYAPs. We are working to champion the promotion of peace and security on the continent. In tandem with the communique of the 807th meeting of the PSC, the Youth for Peace Africa program, in collaboration, of course, with the regional economic communities and the regional mechanism, shortlisted 15 applicants, in which I was one of them, 3 from each of the 5 regions of Africa, so 15 in total, for a training and assessment workshop in November in 2021. The training or the assessment phase provided a platform to sensitize the 15 applicants on the AU normative frameworks and operations on peace and security, and also accorded an opportunity for the RECs and the REMS, the African Union, and the partners to assess our capacity and competencies for a development that facilitated the selection of 1 AYAP per region. So the Youth Ambassadors for Peace, or the AYAPs, we are working under the direct supervision of the Political Affairs, Peace and Security Department of the Commission, And we are championing the promotion and advocacy of youth participation in peace and security issues at both the national, regional, and continental level. Specifically, we are promoting the 5 priority areas of the Continental Framework on Youth Peace and Security, which are guided by Article 17 of the AU Youth Charter and the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2250, 2419, and 2535. Through our mandate, we are trying to promote the Continental Framework for Youth Peace and Security, the African Union Youth Charter, especially Article 17, the UN Security Council Resolution 2250, 2419, and 2535. There is also a huge focus on the national action plans on youth peace and security. So we are trying to work closely with the governments of our regions to implement or to support the member states in implementing, drafting, and launching their national action plans. And that, in a way, supports the ongoing needs and the existing gaps in relation to youth, their peace and security in the continent. Overall, this has been a very enriching experience. We have just concluded 1 year and we have another year to go. Our mandate should end in February 2024. That's where the upcoming cohort will officially assume office after the PSC official announcement in Addis Ababa. It's a very exciting mandate. It's also an opportunity for us to leverage on our knowledge, to skill up on some of the topics of our interest, and to build capacity to be fully prepared to take on other leadership positions in Africa or beyond.
And during the month of April, which was just now last month, we're recording this on the 4th of May, maybe releasing a little later, but just to help with the timeline a little bit. So just last month, Tunisia chaired the Peace and Security Council of the African Union Commission, which promotes good governance, peace, security, and stability throughout Africa. So kind of a two-folded question. What does this mean to chair the Peace and Security Council? What kind of things is a country in charge of? And what topics were important for Tunisia to bring to the agenda? And was there any accomplishments that stand out to you from this month?
As you may know, the Peace and Security Council, or the PSC, is the high-level decision-making organ of the African Union for the prevention, management, and resolution of conflict. It's a collective security and early warning arrangement that intends to facilitate timely and efficient responses to conflict and crisis situations in Africa. The PSC is considered the most important organ in terms of decision-making and the policies at the AU. And they have 15 members elected, some for permanent positions of 2 to 3 years, and some as observers. And the chairmanship of the Peace and Security Council goes on a rotation through an alphabetic order. And for the month of April, my country, Tunisia, was the chair of the Peace and Security Council, during which Tunisia worked on achieving its vision of finding peaceful, just, and sustainable solutions to different African problems for a secure, stable, and prosperous continent. So in the same context, Tunisia acted during its presidency as a force for positive recommendations. Also, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Migration, and Tunisians Abroad tried to intervene in some of the meetings that are related to the ongoing situation of Sudan and the alerting conflicts that are happening as well. The overall objective of the chairmanship is to support security and stability on the continent based on the African principles of solidarity, complementarity that the founding partners of the African Union called for. During the Peace and Security Council chairmanship, Tunisia focused a lot on the ongoing conflicts happening in Sudan. And for this reason, they hosted an emergency session to discuss the ongoing challenges and how they can cease the fire between the authorities in Sudan and how to actually build a space for dialogue between all parties, as well as other different important topics such as corruption, the elimination of illicit arms, and many more challenges that are related to violent extremism in Africa. Overall, the whole month of April was, I would say, focusing on the Sudan case, and it was an excellent opportunity for Tunisia to discuss how the peace and security can intervene as a mediator to cease the fire and to reduce the uncertain stages that Sudan has reached. And it was also the opportunity to showcase the great diplomatic efforts of the Tunisian government and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and our delegation in Ethiopia at the African Union and their capabilities in moderating such sensitive and delicate processes at the African Union level.
Before wrapping up our conversation, let's zoom out just a little bit. How can governmental bodies and multilateral initiatives better incorporate the experiences and needs of women and youth in peacebuilding? So how can we move beyond giving people a seat at the table?
I think this falls exactly into the current work that we are trying to do. We are trying to go beyond from just giving young people a seat at the table. I think by acknowledging the potential of young people today, we have to have a clear recognition and a clear acknowledgement that today young people, they have the full capacities to lead, to participate effectively in policy. They can actually lead on different and delicate conversations, and they are capacitated to represent their countries and beyond. There is another issue that most people tend to neglect, that is the issue of trust. Building trust with young people is very important because it's the basis of a very sustainable and longer relationships, I would say. So when we build intergenerational dialogues, we are building also a trust. We are building a bond with young people in a way that we give them the message that, yes, we hold hands with you and we invite you to contribute as much as we do to the ongoing events that are happening globally. And that young people are impacted by either directly or indirectly. So what's missing actually is to give them this sort of trust, give them this opportunity to lead. I wouldn't say it's an opportunity to test out the potential because we don't need to validate our capabilities any longer. We are witnessing today how brilliant the participation of young people is. We are seeing how young people are representing at the global level the different fields, either at entrepreneurship, in education, in economy, in diplomacy, and more. We know that young people today are very capacitated. So we just need to grant this trust for them to move forward and to allow them to create the future that they want in the spaces and the format that actually meets the needs and demands of young people. I think multilateral initiatives should be more inclusive to youth, being both men and women, and acknowledge how important it is today to have this dialogue with young people. Because if you are promoting good governance, peace and security towards a more stable and prosperous Africa, you cannot neglect young people as they represent more than half of the continent. And as Africa is the youngest continent in the world, being capacitated by young people or being full of potential of young people, it's very important that Africa today uses this treasure and uses this power of youth that it has to invest in it and to capacitate it and to build all efforts in the multilateralism spaces, in diplomacy and beyond, to actually create a better incorporation for young people today and tomorrow, and acknowledge them not only as beneficiaries, but also as contributors and partners.
Great. I have one very small follow-up, if you'll let me. How can these things that you've outlined from youth engagement, from participation of women at many levels, how can this be used to inform the common African position on climate, peace, and security that's currently being developed that will be presented at COP28?
I really like how the questions are really centered around youth. And I think this is one of the rare podcasts that I took part in that are really focusing on youth capabilities and youth interests. I think I have a small example, but I'm not sure if it answers directly this question. Last year, for example, in 2022, we took part in the AS1 Forum, which was around climate security and the nexus between climate change, peace and security in Africa. And we participated as the Youth Ambassadors for Peace, the five of us. We also had high-level representatives from the AU, the UN, different embassies and beyond. And we had a roundtable specifically for youth, and it was about the ongoing challenges that youth are facing with climate change and how that leads to their security. And the recommendations that we presented, they made it to COP27, which was some of the recommendations, of course, my colleagues and I, the youth ambassadors, made. They made it to the final outcome document that was presented at COP27. Now, as much as this is a huge for us, we know that we just don't want theory anymore, and we just don't want policies anymore. We just need action. And whenever we are making recommendations, the overall aim or the objective is that we need to see at least one concrete action or implementation of that recommendation that we made. And I think this year we have a much higher chance at COP28, considering that young people are being more present. And the Conference of the Youth that comes just right before COP is a great opportunity for young people to draft recommendations and proposals in the different thematics, that is of adaptation, mitigation, climate finance, and more. I think all of this falls under one common objective, that is, where does youth stand today? We are really participating. We are really trying to create the opportunities for ourselves. We are having some support to some extent, yes, but we still lack a lot of access opportunities. We still face a lot of barriers. We are concerned about what's going to happen next. So it's every year there is a call to action to the member states and to the officials. And we are really tired of seeing the theory side of it. We just want concrete actions. And I think these actions can only be brought to life if young people were the contributors to it. I hope that through this upcoming edition of COP in the UAE, there will be enough opportunities for young people to lead some of the outcomes and to contribute to them. And we see some milestones or some highlights or the first time changes happening by young people. Young people that can be experts in climate, they can be experts in migration or beyond. We just need to finally have some acknowledgement that today the change that will happen is going to happen either for the youth, by the youth, or in partnership with the youth.
I think that's a really strong message to wrap things up on for today. Thank you so much for joining and outlining some factors that are impacting livelihoods and migration in North Africa. From increasing temperatures and drier conditions, rising inequalities and conflict over resources, to policy incoherence. And of course, for outlining the role of youth as experts in spaces like the AU and the UN, as well as at conferences like the upcoming COP28.
This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. You can follow our latest updates on Twitter @ClimateDiplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.